Welcome to the range of recordings from the 2014 Dog Guide Handlers Convention held at the Grand Chifty in Adelaide. In this first recording, David Foran speaks to us about dog guides and the NDIS. This presentation comes up after a roll call of people that are in the room. Please enjoy.
This is a Dog Guide Handlers Australia audio presentation.
The first one of its type in Australia, run by consumers, for consumers, and we've got some of the owner consumers here. We've got some guide dog instructors coming in who's going to talk to us about some great range of workshops. Up front, I'll just tell you who made this possible. We've had some great sponsorship, and many of you in the room have been able to access some of this funding for you to be able to get over here from CMI Dogs Australia, from Guide Dogs Australia, Royal Society for the Blind, providing some in-kind support. You'll notice on your tables, don't rip those bags open and stuck into those tricks to protect your dogs. And they're supplied by BN Snacks, and we've got a box full of different snacks up here that we'll be doing using for giveaways along the way, and thanks for Nadia for sorting that one out. We've also got a dog massage person coming in later on this afternoon from Blueprint Studios. And we've got a backpack that we'll show during the equipment workshop. And who was that from America?
What?
The backpack.
That was from Catherine Beaton of Victoria.
Catherine Beaton from Victoria.
She sort of makes them and sells them.
Yeah.
Of your own dogs at the moment. Yeah.
Yeah.
The Victorian dogs have them, so it's worth having a look at.
Well, have a look at
on the harness.
Oh, wow. During the equipment place, we've got a dog bowl in here too. Also, the Grand Chifley. Thanks very much to the Grand Chifley, and they've already given us a few prizes. They've given us a free night's accommodation for our raffle later on, and that's in the executive suites at the very top of the hotel. So we put that into a raffle. I realise that might be difficult for people outside of South Australia, but if they live, they might be able to pass it on to somebody else. And me and Erica, at a great expense, had to go and do a Barossa Winery tour the other day to get another raffle prize. So we did that. And a beautiful bottle of wine. It's a $55 bottle of wine, a sealed up nettle at the current London Wine Show, whatever they call that. It was a winner of that, or silver medalist of that, so we've got a bottle of wine there. We've got all sorts of handouts along the way as we go along. What we might do, as we like to do, is we've got a roving microphone here, we might do a roll call. And you can let us know your name, your dog, and where you're from, everybody knows who's in the room. And we've got a roving microphone person.
Yeah. I've just finished your name tags.
Yep. Yeah, thank you.
I've name tagged the people that are in the room.
Lovely. I'll start. Greg Maxson, I'm the president of Dog Guide Handlers Australia. My guide dog is Nicholas, and I'm the first.
And I'm Eric Webb, and I'm from Perth as well. I'm co-secretary of DQHA, and I also do all their social media, and I'm dogless.
I'm Vanessa Ransley from Tasmania, and my guide will be Felton.
I'm Ross from Bundaberg, but I'm keeping
up to see the dogs
all.
You can keep your name on the phone. I'm Annette from Dubbo in New South Wales, and my dog is Delta.
I'm Anna Saxon from Canberra, and my dog is Elster. And sitting next to me when she's at the back is Anne Barrow from Perth, who has
adopted dog. Okay, David's having trouble hearing, so if everyone could use their big outside voice, please.
You need to speak right into the microphone.
I'm Edna Melvin. I'm from Melbourne, and my dog is Ula.
I'm Nadia Machado, I'm from Melbourne, I'm a committee member of Dog Guide Handlers Australia, and my loud dog is Howard, he's a springer dog.
Hi, I'm Harry Vanjack. I'm Client Services Manager at CNO Dogs Australia and an instructor. And it's great to be here for this inaugural conference, and I'll be excited about presenting to you tomorrow morning.
Pam Haig from Warrigal in Victoria, and my dog, his name's Willoughby, from Guide Dogs Victoria.
All right.
I'm Katie, and from New South Wales, and the dog is Ari.
Hi, I'm Joanne. I'm from Adelaide, and I'm in between dog at the moment.
Hi, I'm Nicole,
I'm from Queensland, and my dog is Huey. Hi, I'm Katie, I'm from Perth, I'm vice president of CGHA, and my dog is Collie.
My name is David, I'm from Perth, I'm moving to Melbourne. I have been my dog called Fiona. And look forward to meeting you all.
My name's Henry. I'm a member, and my guide dog's name is Chris.
Hi, I'm Penny Rogers, and I'm from Perth, and my guide dog's called Simba.
Didn't hear you.
Didn't you?
That was Penny Rogers from Perth, and her dog's name is Simba.
My name is Joyce Wachauba. I'm on the DGHA committee, and my guide dog is Quinny from Guide Dogs Queensland.
My name is Penny Stevenson from Victoria, and my seeing eye dog is Hermione.
My name's Valerie Mudy, and my guide dog is Santo, and he's a seeing eye dog's Australia dog.
My name's Paul Mudy, and I'm accompanying Valerie, my wife.
Thank you, everyone. That's everyone that's in the room at the moment.
Okay, thanks very much. As far as housekeeping stuff goes, I'm going to move away from the microphone so you know where I am. I'm over here in the corner, and over in this corner where I am behind me, if an alarm goes off for a fire, there's a glass door that will open behind me, and that will be your exit from this fire, to be over in this corner. And if it is, it will be the way you came in. Toilets are in the foyer, near the lifts, and I'm guessing, is anybody here having any difficulty with the orientation for dog crawling areas? Everyone pretty good?
Yeah, I'm in big trouble.
You'll find that the one who resided with this hotel, and thanks very much to Geraldine Lane, who I unfortunately had to pull out at the last minute, put us onto this this hotel with its various accommodation solutions that it has, but also the fact that there's a lot of park area here to be able to toilet dogs in a reasonable and easy area with some safety. So thanks very much to Geraldine. I'm going to mention other mentions. There's a couple of people here that have indicated that they're on the Dog Guide Handlers committee, Nadia, Tracy, Joyce, who else have we got in the room here? That's it. But also, not in the room here, Nicole Mara, not in the room here today, couldn't make it, Rowena Dowling, Bill Menzie, Jamie Kelly, and I think that's it, and they're the people that sort of had the idea to put this conference together and put it together, and we'll see how it goes. It started off okay, and I'm sure it will continue on as we go. Our first workshop is going to be, first up, has anybody got any questions at all about the hotel, about the arrangements? I will tell you that we're going to have morning tea at 11 o'clock. That will be in this room here.
Paul Adrian's also come into the room since then, and he's from Guide Dogs Victoria. And if anyone does have a question, stick your hand up so I can bring the microphone to you. Yep, okay, furthest person away.
I've got enough voice, probably.
No,
I don't need a microphone.
We need a microphone. No, it's not that sort of microphone.
Oh, okay.
I want to know. Hi, Anna.
Yep.
I just want to know if it's a wheelchair accessible toilet down here, because I need it for balance purposes.
I haven't actually had a look, but we can certainly find out.
I think it might be. I did barely even notice it, but there seemed to be one of each and the extra one, so I'm guessing the extra one is the wheelchair accessible toilet.
Thank you. Yes, so morning tea is going to be in here at 11 o'clock. Lunch will be in the restaurant, and that's just out the door that you came in and off to the right-hand side. Just grab any table when we're going to go and have lunch. It'll be the buffet, but there will be staff that will be able to assist you. Afternoon tea later on this afternoon will be in this room. And on a room, if you went out of this room and turned to your right and went down a couple of metres, there is another room similar to this. That's where the dinner will be tonight. So that's the hotel staff. Hotel staff are very keen to assist. Later on, we're going to try. There's a deck area behind me that will be open up during morning tea. So there's going to be dog bowls out there for your dogs. And sometime during the 2 days, we're going to attempt to get a photo of the 24 or 25 dogs we've got in one shot.
Water.
All right. The first session we have, just David Farron was going to talk to us. He's going to talk to us about NDIS and the consumer's perspective around the NDIS. So he's in the air at the moment and on his way here. So what I thought we might do with this session, we might flip it over, and rather than tell you how dog guides might fit into an NDIS, because still that's a very open-ended question at the moment, and I can tell you what I do know, and that is that it will be schools that will still provide dog guides, but if you are in that age category that can get into an NDIS, and that is people who are under the age of 65, when the NDIS rolls out in your particular area, it looks like you'll be able to build a package around the maintenance of that dog, say probably vet bills, food, some equipment, possibly orientation and mobility. We don't know how it's going to fit in. As I said, these questions are still very much open-ended, as I'm not aware of anybody who is in one of the launch areas that have gone through the process of getting a guide dog through the NDIS as yet. There are a few people, I believe, that are going to start that process. So as those people go through the NDIS, we'll know a little bit more about that. So I thought what we might do talk about today is what you might like to see in an NDIS to be able to cater for the needs of you and your dog. So we might open up questions in and around that, if anybody's got any questions that we can gather. By the way, just to let you know, we're recording these sessions so that people do request that we do that, so that later on, when we get home, we get a bit of time, put those into MP3 files and put them up on the website so those people can listen to the sessions as they were going to be here. So, there goes, just remind you, this is a recorder on. But I've got one going as well. We're going to record the session. So what we might do is open up to the floor and ask people, what have they heard about an NDIS and guide dogs, or what would they like to see catered for in NDIS? As I say, so we can gather that information, and when asked, we can feed information into the NDIA, the National Disability Insurance Agency, about what needs dog guide handlers might have.
Before you do that, Greg,
yep.
Michelle and Stephanie want to let you know that they've arrived as well.
Okay, welcome, Michelle and Stephanie.
And whereas I thought it was actual question, it was actually just them announcing their arrival.
I do have a question.
Yes.
And because I'm standing right here with Michelle, I'll give her the microphone.
And Michelle, you're from South Australia, and Stephanie, you're from Victoria?
Yeah, that's right.
Right, the question I have been burning to ask ever since they mentioned guidance part of an NDIS package is how can they possibly work out how much a guide dog is going to cost per year, because we have no idea from year to year what is going to happen to our dogs or how much O&M we're going to need if that's included. Yes, we can probably calculate food costs, bathing costs if we decide to do hybrid bathing, whatever. That sort of thing, but as far as the vet bills and the O&M factors are concerned, how on earth are they going to calculate that?
Well, what I think they will do is when you get a package with an NDI within the NDIA, it's not a constant thing. It gets reviewed on a regular basis, and you can ask for it to be reviewed. So I would suggest that there will probably be some assessment, and these are the questions we don't know. And just to let you know, we did try to get somebody from the NDIS to come and speak to us today. We used their telephone leave a message system, got no response from that. I used an email feedback form, got an email back saying they were going to pass it on to the engagement team. I was also given a telephone number of somebody that I could contact within the engagement team and left about 15 messages. We didn't get a single response back.
I've contacted the call centre and left a message with the wonderful entry-level call centre person who was going to pass it on to... He wasn't clear who, but he was going to pass it on. And they did respond to me saying, no, we don't have anyone who will come and talk to your conference on your national conference.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, nice. That needs to be dealt with. Absolutely.
That is,
I think an MP or something needs to be contacted about that, because I find this issue comes up a lot. I think this issue needs to be dealt with, because I find issues around people who are blind and have low vision do get pushed aside because they're not quite as dramatic as those that need 24-hour care. And I think we need the sort of information, because we're going to cost the nation a lot less if we're able to maintain our independence.
Absolutely.
And the other thing I wanted to know is when all of us reach 65, how do we know that, like, 65 is now the new 45 apparently, and how do we know that we're going to get the same level of care?
Mm.
And I think somehow that needs to be
caught
up.
Some of us
passed that thing. Oh, are they? Well, fortunately, I can't see.
Okay, when people call out, it makes it really difficult for people who are hard of hearing in the room to hear what's being said. It gets muffled as you talk over each other. Please try and be courteous.
And can they say their names, please?
Yes, that's a good idea.
Oh, sorry.
We've got plenty of time. It's only just the start. There's going to be a lot of discussion going on. We're not just going to be standing up here talking at you all the time. We certainly want people to get involved. And thanks very much for that. But just to answer some of those questions that Penny had, if you are in an NDIS before you're 65, you can remain in the NDIS. You don't go off once you get past 65. If you are over 65, you need to be into an aged care sector. And there again, there's going to be questions in and around what happens to those people, because we know the majority of people who lose their sight do it over the age of 65. You know, like 70% of people lose their sight at that sort of age. So these are our questions. And through the Australian Blindness Forum, which is made up of the guide dog schools, BCA, and other consumer groups, have had already a couple of forums with the powers that be at the top end of the NDIA, and pointing out some of these problems. And that's probably why At this stage, it's difficult to get somebody to come in and talk about it because they haven't really worked it out how it's going to work. And those discussions only just happened like a couple of months ago with the Australian Blindness Forum. So, and that's why I think it's interesting just to grab your comments today so we can feed those into the discussions that are going on, because as yet I don't think consumers are really very involved apart from, their delegates through Blind Citizens Australia. And Dr. Hands Australia certainly try to get into those negotiations as well as it comes about what the hand was. And also, Penny, we are going to be writing to the NDIA and let them know how to speak to her, because it's not the only example that we've got of recent times of not being able to get somebody to come to speak at one of our conferences.
It's Penny from Victoria here, just to tag on to the other Penny. I have just two musings, I suppose. I'm just interested to find out what's going to happen, if you have a dog that, it doesn't work out, there's something goes wrong, after 4 years or after, 2 years or after 6 months, how's the system ever going to cope with, shelling out $35,000 or $40,000 and then having to go through it all over again, I think that's just going to be an interesting thing to watch. And secondly, I think the other thing that I'm going to be interested about is for clients who need dual qualified dogs, I wonder whether there's going to be an opening for, schools to be needing to provide dual qualified dogs, for people in wheelchairs or, who want deaf and guide dogs,
epilepsy dogs.
Yeah, absolutely. Dual qualified, any kind of assistance dogs. I think it's going to be a very interesting space to watch because, whether there'll be a lot of new startups, trainers offering them privately. So yeah, that's just my comments, I suppose.
Thanks,
Okay, the next question is going to be from Nicole.
Yeah, my question kind of follows on from Penny in that, for me, for reasons that I won't get into, the dog I've currently got is going to be retired and I've only had this 1 year. And, there was a lot of sort of negotiations with the school and whatever to we finally arrive at the decision that this dog's, guaranteed to be withdrawn. But, what I'm wondering is, in the event that happens in the future, do I have to start trying to negotiate with some NDIA, overarching body and say, okay, look, this isn't working out, the school's agreeing, but am I allowed to get more money, or tourists are going to have to go back in hand to this organisation and try and justify to them as well as to the school why they're having these issues? Because it's hard enough to negotiate with the school when it's not working out, let alone trying to explain to some outside third party that doesn't really understand
kind of ability necessarily why it may not be working out. I'm just concerned
that we'll get pressure
from some overarching organisation going, no, just keep trying, it'll work out. But when it's not. So I guess that's just my concern.
May I respond to that?
Yes.
Michelle from Adelaide here. I would suggest, Nicole, that the schools, there should be some kind of proviso made that the schools have the final authority on the future of the dog or on the team, the partnership. So if the school says this dog has to be retired after going into all the proper channels and testing, it should be like going to your doctor and getting something filled out to say that you're too disabled to walk 100 metres so you can get a parking permit, or you are now at the point you need a wheelchair. I believe that the Guide Dog Schools and Dog Guide Handlers Australia and BCA need to work together to make sure that the bureaucrats don't have the final say on the future of our partnerships, because Nicole is right. They don't know anything about guide dog mobility or personal safety in between a guide dog and the handler. So that's what I would put forward as a dog guide handler.
Okay, thanks for that. We're going to rest the questions for a minute, so keep the questions there. David's right, so I might hand over to David. I know a little bit about David, but I'll let him talk about him mostly. I do know he's been on the Vision of 2020, which is one of the consumer-based, well, partly consumer-based, government style, or not government-backed, but certainly a entity that has the ear of government. And David's been involved in that for a long time, so I'll hand over to David. And David's from Victoria, so please welcome David.
Great, thanks very much. So I've just come in from Melbourne. It sounded like it's going on quite well without me, so those questions I think are really, the ones I heard, are very important, and hopefully there'll be more of those. And so I understand we're recording proceedings today and tomorrow,
yes.
So that if there are questions that we don't know, and I certainly don't know anywhere near enough as I should, or as any of us should, but I think what we've learned, if anything, about these processes is that there's a lot of unknowns. And I don't want to get into a Rumsfeld moment, but there's a lot of unknown unknowns. And I think it's really up to us as a community of users to drive. I mean, whenever I've come across uncertainty in the system, be it when I was doing the national advocacy work for Vision 2020 Australia, or as a consumer of blinders and low vision services or anything, anytime the government, and I spent 2 decades in defence as a senior defence scientist, so if you ever want to know how bureaucracy works or doesn't work, defence is a pretty good portfolio to spend some time in. And it's brought me to Adelaide quite a lot, you'll be wrapping up for the VSTO out there. But what it often presents as when there's uncertainty is actually opportunity, and I think we've got to be prepared to galvanise our resources. And make use of the fact that we actually, in the last comment there, I can't remember the name of the lady who said it, but we actually know something about this space. And I think what the agency, the NDIA, while it might present sometimes a bit of a monolith, I think what they really do want is our answers and solutions. Because they don't have the expertise, the time, or the will to deliver it themselves. So if we can come together and get some clarity about what we would see as a useful way of going forward, that actually does their job for them. And so I see it more as a partnership, and trust me, I've found it hard sometimes to be a friend of the scheme. And I think maybe more like a Facebook friend than like a real friend. You call it notionally a friend, but slagging off behind their back all the time. But I think it's really about trying to find a balance between trying to help and trying to be part of it and being critical in a constructive way, because I think that's how we're going to get the best result. So, because they don't know, right? And they don't have the authority to decide in some of these cases, but it doesn't mean they're going to make the right decision. So our responsibility to ourselves and to our dogs is to try and make sure that those decisions are actually made in an informed way. So that's what I've tried to set myself up in a sense. I was sort of employed by Vision 2020 Australia, I think largely because no one else wanted to read the draft report from the Productivity Commission. So I was stupid enough to say, I'll do that. And when you got it in accessible format, probably wasn't too bad. But so that spent a lot of my time sort of from a very early stage recognising where I saw some of the limitations with respect to the low vision blindness space and other bits of the disability sector, and tried to influence all the way through this. And you fight the unwinnable fight of trying to unite the low vision blindness community. I mean, that's a challenge in and of itself, but that is just a testament to the fact that everyone has some pretty strong views and there's some really good personal input to be made. So it is one of the challenges I find in the sector is that we are very, very poor at uniting. And while that isn't often a deliberate strategy of governments, perhaps might be different for the current one, but division and conquering is something we don't really want to put out there as an option for people. So I really encourage people to be constructive in the criticism and be vociferous, but be prepared to acknowledge sometimes that get ground given is sometimes going to get us to a better place. But anyway, so just by way of introduction, I suppose I've come to this position. I've only been a dog handler 6 months. Oliver came to me from Guide Dogs Victoria back in March, and he's been, well, he's making us look good because he knows what he's doing. So that's my excuse at the moment, but soon I won't, and certainly when I get the benefit of time with experienced dog handlers like yourselves, I will have no more excuses. So I hope to learn a lot about some of what it's like to, you know, to experience handling for a while, and with the benefits of speaking to people who have been there a lot longer than I have. I had spent some time, as I mentioned, in defence as a human factors and human engineering scientist. So again, much of the focus there was about human user requirements and trying to understand the way people and humans operate in sometimes not complex systems and sometimes some fairly complex socio-technical systems. And for me, having recognised that when defence asked me to go and see a medical officer because my vision was no good anymore, and of course they sent me a letter, and I asked for that in an accessible format, and when the answer was no, I realised that that was probably going to be a long, hard fight to fight that battle from within that system. So I gracefully decided to step outside the tent and continue to fight outside, and since then I've established a private disability advisory / consulting service, which is trying to bridge the gap often between the resources and the decision makers and the users, because so often we're not speaking the same language, and I think that's part of the difficulty is trying to get the government and those who are developing programs and advocating for programs to actually understand some of the real world implications of what's going on. And having spent that amount of time in defence and government, I can walk that side of the street if absolutely forced to. I don't want to, but sometimes it's the only way you can ever get anyone to understand what you're talking about. So it's a bit of an interlocutor role and a responsibility to try and say, well, we can do this better if we can, up and down the line, communicate and interpret effectively what our real needs and what our different beliefs and desires and wishes are. So, and of course, disability is such a lucrative sector to put yourself into in the private sector. It's a wash with money. So, but I think it's a necessary evil, and it's one of those things that, like another road to Damascus moment in a sense, but I've been put here for a reason, and I've lost my vision for a reason now. I can't sit back and spend too much time feeling a bit disconcerted by that. It is what it is, but the training I had hitherto, the time I spent with Vision 2020 Australia, and the academic background for me says I've got to do something with that. And so for me it's about trying to, particularly around the low vision and blindness space, do something useful. You know? Not just do something, but do something useful. So I've tried to get a capacity to help organisations and individuals even, but take away some of the angst around dealing with the bureaucracy of some of these things and trying to interpret what really are requirements that are worth paying attention to and what are the ones that you can avoid wasting your own valuable resources on, or let someone else do it if better equipped, because we spend a lot of time chasing grants, chasing resources, chasing programs that aren't really designed for us, although they're dressed up and present as such, but sometimes they're not really what we need to do. So one of the useful things I do, I think, is actually to tell organisations, don't bother. Don't spend your time, effort and money doing things that are actually a bit more central and meaningful for your user group or for your stakeholders. So what I had hoped today was to get this conversation going, because no one wants to listen to me for very long. Although you're not my family, so you may be more polite. But having them in Adelaide, I actually got my Father's Day presents yesterday. So I said, I love a pair of white socks, apparently, with a whole lot of colours, letters and stuff on them. So that was for my five-year-old. So I'll be wearing those tomorrow.
They're not black, white and teal, are they?
No, they would have been blue and gold. They should have been, but we won't speak too much of that. I did spend 6 years in Perth. So that's where I picked up that nasty habit of the West Coast Eagles.
They're better than the Crows.
Go Eagle.
Yeah, it's a race to the bottom, I think, in Melbourne between the Crows and West Coast. So I was fairly quiet over in Perth and Melbourne with respect to West Coast. But they started up when I was in Perth, so whenever you got to Melbourne, you had to have a club. You couldn't be clubless in Melbourne, it's just impossible. So that was as good a club as I could. And it was good in the early 90s, it was really good, but not so good these days. So what I'd hoped really was to make this an exercise in a conversation. And of course, if there are questions, I think yell them out. And as I said, if I don't have the answers, and I certainly don't have them all by any stretch, but I think it is for us to, yeah, whatever they are, we'll get them answered and the challenge out of this session today. And tomorrow for me will be just get the questions around the NDIS and the NDIA that we don't know, and then feed that back to you guys, in emails or whatever later on. So there are no stupid questions ever. The only stupid question is one that goes unasked. So feel free to question or to throw in anything. No raised hands, obviously, that's the rules. I like delivering presentations now because I've got a really good excuse not to use PowerPoint. And even better in this space, because even if I did, many people probably wouldn't know or care. But I've been anti-PowerPoint for decades, even before I lost most of my vision, so right now it's a good way to be. It's almost a bit cleaner. And apparently less snooze-worthy, I've been told. So anyway, hopefully that's the case. To kick it off, I suppose there's some really basic questions, and we never know the level of people's understanding around what the NDIS and the NDIA are. And I suppose simply put, the NDIS is just the scheme, and the NDIA, the agency, is just the agency that runs it, and they're the people who are making the decisions. And
we have a question over here.
Yes.
Hi, my name is Nadia, and thanks, David, for coming and talking to us. I think what you're saying about a united front and that whole divide and conquer stuff is really pertinent, and I think it's relevant for us as consumers, I guess, and also the dog guide organisations to actually work together to get some decent outcomes for the agencies as well as the. I have a comment and a question. My comment relates, sorry David, back to the discussion we were having before you came, and contacting the NDIS and finding actually someone who will actually talk to you. I found someone. I work in local government and I don't know how I did it, but I've actually found someone in Geelong who's involved in community engagement who will return my call. And I'm actually taking one of our community groups to meet with her in November. So I'm planning to develop that link and have you to then ask her about where our best opportunity for bringing our thoughts and ideas from this conference to the NDIS and to the agency, how best to do that.
You're happy to reveal her identity now?
I can't remember her name. She's from the Geelong local area, and I think it'll come to me probably about 4 o'clock tomorrow morning, so I'll just kind of stick my head out of my room and yell it.
Not a Deborah, not a Alex?
No, it might be Alex, but I'm not sure because I've just been to an NDIA conference and Alex spoke there, but no, it wasn't her. And my question actually is, and I'm not sure whether you or the instructor Paul or Harry that are here today can answer it or can update us on how progress is going with the agency. I understand that there is a monetary value on the dogs, it's touted $35,000, whatever the going cost for training is. But that's actually after the dogs have been trained. So my question is, and my comment is, we really need to know who forks out that money originally, like I'm presuming it's the agency, and where do they get that money? If they're going to lose, possibly funding in other areas because of the NDIS, and I'm not sure if that's the case, where did the initial money to train the dog and support the dog through that process come? And do they have to do that, and then do they get paid back once the dog actually succeeds? And if the dog doesn't succeed, what happens?
Now, there are others better qualified here, I think, to answer that, but I think it's probably.
Yes, I am.
Would you be happy to answer that, or as best you could, without me poking up?
I'm sure you can actually provide some clarity around that, because in terms of costs and so on, there isn't a lot of
clarity as yet. All the guide dog organisations in Australia today rely on some level of government funding and a large degree of philanthropy, and that will continue into the future, I suspect, so that we can continue to provide services to those consumers who are not NDIS eligible. In terms of the way we operate, I think you could look at the funding we receive from the NDIS eventually is a recovery of the cost that we've expended along the way, along the journey, just as with any other business. If you run a shop, you pay to keep the stock on the shelf, so to speak, and then you recover your costs when you actually move that stock along. That's not perhaps a great analogy, but effectively that's the way the business will work under this model.
I think, simply put, it is directed by the engagement of an individual with the system and the delivery of an assessment that has a dog as part of that agreed plan. So once that's the trigger to say, if you have an existing relationship with a service provider who produces dogs, then the agency would expect you to go and get a quote from that service provider for the dog, and that would drive that process, because we know you don't just go off. The shop analogy, it works in a sense, but you don't go to the shop and get your dog off the next day. So there's a whole process of volunteering, no doubt, a lawyer. So that would kick that process off. I don't think there's a resolution about what happens if a dog fails yet, but obviously it's like as if your wheelchair failed, or if your computer failed, or if another item supplied by the scheme ceased to be fit for purpose, then the scheme has an obligation. And then the agencies know that sometimes a dog is not fit for purpose, but it's fit for another purpose. So I don't think we're not going to sit back and be beholden to a system that can end up with having someone not having the need that's agreed and assessed as part of their plan. There may be delays if you need to get another dog halfway through it, up to 2 years or 1 year or however long it might be earlier than planned. We as users are not out of pocket in that sense, and we aren't out of pocket now in terms of the provision of dogs, and the scheme would be the monies is actually for certain items, there's a relationship between the agency and the service provider. So there's no third party in this. There's only two parties involved in the supply of the dogs, as far as I can understand the system.
I've come into the NDIS from a late point of view, because I'm from WA, it's Erica. I've had a look at the NDIS price lists that they price items against for people who are vision impaired. And on the price list, it has no cost for the dog, but there's a costing of, I think it's, how much was it, Greg, for the cost of upkeep of the dog?
$2,500 was notional. I was going to talk about that as well. Yeah.
But it doesn't say what's in or out with that.
No. I mean, we'll talk about that now if you like. But the idea, the reason probably there is no dollar value for a dog is that it may not yet have been determined exactly, because there may not be certainty about the cost for each agency who produces dogs to say this is what it costs us to do that, because each of them has a different setup or a different arrangement about how they want to do their kenneling or their breeding program or their training. So they're not going to be far apart from each other, and of course the agency, in true neoliberal style, of course wants to create a market economy around this as well. So the best thing that we've done, I think, as a sector, is that the key agencies, everyone who produces dogs, that's the guide dog entities in each state and territory, or covering each state and territory, and RSB and CEDA, have all got around the table with NDIA management in Canberra and are nutting out and have nutted out these deals in terms of how they expect the dog handlers to be, the needs are to be met under the scheme. So take that as a good example is the care and maintenance package that you alluded to there, Erica, is currently set at $2,500 a year. And that would include your basic consumables around holding onto a dog. So probably your leash, your harness wear, veterinary expenses, worming, boarding costs, any of those sorts of costs that you relate to the daily upkeep and maintenance of the animal are packaged up at $2,500. That's not necessarily the limit, if you have particular circumstances that you have a need around different things, then that's part of your agreed package and may well be negotiated. And you will have to acquit that by the end of each year, and it's paid quarterly, as far as I can understand. It's really important for those people who are in launch areas now to do that, actually, to get on in that system. If you are in a launch area and have a dog, really important you do, because that's money that's available now. You have to engage the system and deal with that as a process, but that will be money that you hitherto haven't actually had access to at all. So that, and no doubt, hopefully that will change with time, upwards as we get a better idea of what are the full and true costs for all of the dog handlers that engage the system.
David, it's Erica again. You probably don't know the answer to this, but it makes sense to me that harnesses and vet fees and those sorts of costs would be considered reasonable and necessary because the dog is a working animal. But would food be considered a reasonable expense, or would that just be considered different?
Oh, come on. Yeah, sure it would.
I think it's...
Because other people have pets and dogs and other sort of dependents that have, that they have to feed and they're not covered by an NDIS.
Yeah, but theirs aren't working dogs.
Yeah, food is in as a necessary, like fuel would be for a vehicle.
Yeah, exactly.
If you look at the ATO in terms of, like Oliver can be considered for me, if I'm a paid employee, as a tool of the trade. So I can claim the cost of running him as anyone else who has a business, because without him I can't operate a business. So if the ATO is any guide as to the sorts of things that might be included, no doubt the bureaucracy is running that themselves. But food is one of those things that would be included, and is, I think, is on the list. I think already before you can confirm that.
Yes.
Yeah. So there's $1,000 of that 2,500. I mean, this guy, I've got a very big dog, he's 42 kilos, and so he eats about as much as I do. But so I'll be up. So if it turns out that there's more, bigger expense for one dog versus another, then that's how you review that. I don't think we can just sit back. We can't afford to sit back and say everybody is the same. We know there's variability in the way we do it. We can rely on the guide dog agencies and the other dog providers across Australia to represent their clients' interests. But it's almost like a three-way exercise, and that people who live with the dogs and work with them on a daily basis are going to be informing the system. That's why I said after that we need to gather up the bits of information we can and inform the agency that if they've got it wrong about $2,500, we need to tell them that. And we can tell them that through our service providers, or we can tell them directly through our planners, and this is an area where we cannot afford to simply sit back and let the system deliver what it will deliver, because as everyone who stands up in political land, it's about feasibility, it's about scheme feasibility, and feasibility just means dollars. So it's how much they give to how many people. So we've got a very good start here, I think. We've got, a very good collaboration with the dog providers around Australia. We've got them together, figured out they need to unite behind or with each other to approach the agency about some uniformity, about, okay, dogs are in, here's a notional cost for them. We've recognised there'll be variations around that, but they'll nut out the final figure. And certainly with the care and maintenance package, so too, that's... struck already, and there are people who are getting that. So, I think
and
a lot of
some dogs too require more specific diets that are very expensive to buy too.
And again, this is where this is part of the process where we are driving the assessment process. And it might be right that some of the agencies do have to step up a bit and provide some assistance, certainly to new service users, because there isn't a lot of support. Certainly there isn't anything in the political program.
There's some questions, David.
Oh, okay.
Yep, it's Penny again from Melbourne. I just wanted to put out there the idea that an ongoing cost may be... vaccinations for overseas travel and the veterinary expenses associated with that, because
you know, for anyone that wants to travel overseas on a regular basis, you know, it's easier to actually maintain like rabies vaccinations yearly than actually go through the whole process of, you know, doing the vaccination and then getting the blood test, you know, on a one-off basis. So I just sort of want to put that out there as something that may not have been considered but might need to be.
I think it's a good, and you're talking about, just the dog vaccinations, not yours.
Yeah, dog vaccinations, yeah. Because you have to go to a specific AQUIS, AQUIS or whatever they're called now, approved vet, and have specific vaccinations that can't be done through your local vet centres.
Well, I think this is a really good example of the requirement to have some clear thinking around when you get an assessment done or a plan developed or reviewed. That if you can, the really important message out of today, or one of them is, it isn't like looking at the catalogue and picking out the things you think you'd like, because that's not how the system will respond to the development of a plan. The system will respond to the development of a plan that's tied to need and goals. So if your goal is to be able to travel independently overseas in order to either meet a business or recreational or social need, then that needs to be considered as part of an assessed plan. So therefore, the cost associated with making sure your dog was travel ready would be included, or should be, and you could argue effectively that that's part of your goal set. Mm. If you'd have said that you wanted to tie it into a care package or whatever, and it was an ad hoc sort of requirement, much harder to argue at the end of the day that, oh, by the way, I want to be able to travel around the world in 3 months' time, and where's the money for that?
Mm.
But if your plan is explicit, and this is where it really needs us to individually figure out how to marry up the sorts of things that we know are available in terms of service providers, but now what will happen in the future, with how we articulate that with respect to goals and what that needs. Because that's the underlying premise of all of these plans for an NDIS, is that it's part of a goal that you have, be it in recreational or family life or education, whatever it happens to be. So that's a really important point, because that's a good example of making the system aware of what your goals are, because that's going to be the context in which the plan is determined and funded and delivered.
It's Penny from Perth.
Yeah. Speak right into the microphone.
Speak really close.
Oh, sorry. It's Penny from Perth. You mentioned that word market force or something.
Economy? Market?
Yeah, market economy. I've got two concerns, because it came up when Zell Iskall was on, she's over at an NDS conference, I think, at the moment, but she was very involved in advocacy and what have you, with people who are blind and have low vision. But she was asked on a radio program, can they minimise the NDIS or even gradually get rid of it? That was the first question. And her answer was no, because it's already on the way. But one of my concerns is that they might, with the current overall budgetary thing that we're going through at the moment, just generally, is that they might start means testing the care. That was one thing. And the other thing is the organisations that provide the services might start upping their prices.
Yes.
And, you know, and like when you come from Perth, we've really only got one major provider, and they've all got to make their ends meet too, and they're under enormous pressure to meet that same sort of market economy guideline. I don't know whether I've made myself fairly clear.
It's a feature of what's being imposed, is that they clearly see that the way in which they can keep or try to keep a lid on value for money for the taxpayers' dollar to expend on disability services is to produce a system whereby there's a market. And while it's an interesting exercise now with the guide dog agencies and other dog providers in each state, because on the one hand, you're not allowed to collude, but on the other hand, there's value to the agency to get them around the table and figure out what something's going to cost. Mm. So if Western Australia, somebody wants to quote a dog at $100,000 and the rest of Australia is saying, well, we're $50,000, then the agency actually will have a look at that and say, hang on, there's a sole provider here. I know that sole providers, I did a Cert 4 last year, the sole provider in Australia is $6,000 for Cert 4. It's not like you're joking. So it can happen in the market where there's only one player. But there isn't only one player because the agency is a national and federal body, and it would probably say, well, if that service provider is going to charge $100,000, we might fund that. Well, we might fund 10 or 50,000 plus transport or whatever. They'll come up with a solution. Right. And that, second? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's, in the hypothetical, if someone was going to be so ridiculous about charging that high, if everybody decided to up their prices, much like, I don't know, grocery people or petrol stations. Oh, we've got the ACCC, so we'll all be safe. That's another issue. But again, the costs are limited, and the government we have federally at the moment is very much about reducing government expenditure. And it is a real threat to the system. I mean, to put it in context, the NDIS only helps 500,000 people. No, it's only 500,000 people who will get a package. That's the slated figure. Hasn't been changed much. Originally, I think it was 360, and the draft report went to 410 when they included mental health, people with mental health requirements. It's now gone to 500, but that's probably it.
And so, there's 700,000 on the disability support pension. 850,000 on the disability support pension. So that means it's not covering everyone.
Well, and 2009 ABS stats, there's 1.2 million people with a profound disability. So no matter way you cut it in terms of the disability support, and they're trying to get people off that, so that's not the best measure because there's plenty more people out there who have a profound disability need who aren't getting any support or anywhere near the support they need.
And there's not enough jobs for everybody?
But there will be plenty of jobs in disability services apparently.
Yes, so, they don't take people with disabilities.
Which don't exist.
We're not employable.
They're invisible jobs.
Yes, but you'll be punished for not working. So,
exactly, exactly.
So we don't want to beat up too heavily on government, but you know, it's fun, but we can't spend all weekend doing that. So the system in terms of the market is one where we need to be prepared to recognise that if there are other providers and other people out there that can do things cheaper, then that's, by the same token, it's good for the longevity of the system and its sustainability in an economic government sense. But in theory, it's also supposedly good for those people who want to be able to use their dollars in a more canny fashion and maybe get more out of their packages by being able to spend less doing certain things, and then that might free up dollars to be able to do other things. So, I mean, the big ticket items like dogs and care maintenance packages, I don't think there's going to be a lot of scope for shopping around. I think I heard some mentioning about dual accredited dogs. I mean, I've not heard of them existing, but that doesn't mean they don't exist. It just means I've not heard of them.
I think there is a need for it.
Yeah, but I think there's certainly an issue around accreditation for the system, and the agency is going to want to know what level of accreditation or competency is there about this dog. Mm-hmm. I just can't take a dog out of a pound, give it some obedience training and call it a service dog, or call it a guide dog, or call it an assistance dog. It's not how it works, and they won't be funded.
They do it in America.
They do a lot of things in America, including guide dogs. So,
horses.
Michelle and Nicole have a question.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to go off on a completely different tangent for the moment. We have an issue here in South Australia where I know cases of where every blindness organisation in South Australia has let down a client or clients regarding duty of care. Every single organisation, I'm not just talking about, you know, simple little things, I'm talking about things like cyberbullying, sexual assault, safety, this sort of personal safety, guide dog safety, this sort of stuff, right? Not naming names and I'm not naming organisations, but my concern is if you are one of those clients, or if
there are enough clients who are not happy with these organisations. If these organisations fall, for whatever reason, will all these little tiny businesses emerge? Or what will happen to the organisations? And what will happen if a client is blacklisted because they've said too much about the organisation, and the organisation is either trying to cover it up or you know, responds back, that person is a troublemaker. It could make life very difficult for clients, especially if they're trying to apply for funding for a dog.
Well, I think the important thing to remember, and I'm disappointing to hear that those things have happened, I'm certainly not an apologist either for those organisations or the NDIA. There are dispute resolution mechanisms within the NDIA as well in terms of the relationship between a participant and the agency. And if someone's applying for funds, they're not applying for funds from that guide dog entity. They're actually, the agency is the one who supplies the money for the delivery of the service. Now, typically, is if you've got really bad organisations and that's all you've got to choose from, then that's a personal choice you need to make as a client to say, which one will I go with if I have a choice? And because there may not be anyone else you can go to. But the agency is going to be the one that supplies the money. So the person who is supplying, the entity who is supplying the dog, for example, they want the custom, they want the business, because they're going to try and cost recover the cost of delivering that service. So they don't want to be nasty and horrible to people, at least it makes no economic sense at all, to basically disenfranchise the very people who will be the reason for your being in the future. Doesn't make any sense at all. So maybe that's a lever or an opportunity for people to start advocating to their service providers that we do have the capacity to go elsewhere now, and nobody's bound by the fact that they happen to be currently getting services from one provider. Doesn't mean you have to go there to get anything else ever again, and that's where the market hopefully would come in, so that people can have an option. Now, the theory about businesses coming up, and that's again one of those theories of what an NDIS was going to bring into being. I don't think we want to necessarily see guide dog trainers springing up on every street corner, because what would happen is, in order for that to happen, the level of the standard by which they would be accredited must drop for that to be viable. Yes. So I think you still, and part of the challenge now for the existing, for us as existing handlers, but also the agencies, is to ensure that the very highest level of standard for dogs is maintained, because on the one hand, this will be what the agency wants to achieve. They don't want to have to pay for dogs all over the place. They don't want to have to do that. They want to deal with as few operators as they can. That's the way government departments are working for a long time now. They want few providers, not many. They want organisations to aggregate under a peak body so they can deal with the peak body, not deal with 40 different organisations. It's much more efficient for them to be able to deal with fewer people and more. But also understand that we want to be able to maintain a high level of standards. This is a concern I have into the future, is that as we age and the intergenerational report told us, we're all getting older as if we didn't know, and there's going to be a heap of people around who have used to demanding and getting largely what they want through that course of their life, and they're going to expect the same as they head towards 70, 75, 80. And there's going to be people who demand their dogs of all different types to be their support dogs, companion dogs, psychological support dogs, any number of different types of support animals will be all over the place. And I think it poses a sort of challenge to those dogs and certainly dog guides, and that they will, their primacy or their position in the eyes of the community, I think, may well be threatened by the upsurge in the number of dogs that might be around about. So, while on one hand we do have issues around access in certain places at times, that's fine, but in the main we're protected, and we should continue to advocate under the diverse discrimination legislation and the standards that exist under the DDA, and we should continue to make sure we push for those rights to be upheld at all times. But at the same time, you look at if proprietors and service providers are confronted with 10 times the number of dogs as they do now, how might we then be able to maintain that position and the access that we need if we become one of the pack in a sense. So, you know, people always have different views about whether they're good, bad or indifferent. The way I look at it is that it's got to do with the standards and the level of accreditation dogs that we produce across Australia have. And I think that's a really important bit of it, and we need to make sure that we push our providers, whichever agency it is that supplies the dogs, to keep that advocacy thing up with the government and with the agency to ensure they're at the highest level and don't let that standard drop, because when the standard drops, then that can impact on us all in an access perspective. I think we want to be able to maintain that position as it is without being reduced. And I think it's a potential that might be illusory, but some of these are the things that occasionally I mull over. It'd be interesting to hear other views if anyone has one on that.
My question is about pet insurance, because my last dog, fortunately for me, I had pet insurance on him, and he ended up costing me over $10,000, or my pet insurance company over $10,000 in medical bills, because I retired, and to be fair, school did offer me financial support if I wanted it, but I basically said, look, my pet insurance company aren't a charity, so they can pay both the claims anyway. For the offer. So what I'm wondering is what that might look like under an NDIS package, because I could pretty well argue that, you know, $40 a month to pay for the pet insurance, that ended up saving a heck of a lot more money than if I literally had to go to an NDIS and go, okay, now I need $10,000 because the dog needs to support his surgery. So for me, the pet insurance company, I'm very happy, it wasn't a good policy for them, from their point of view, but it actually saved a lot of money, and it meant that the dog could just have the care that he needed, and I wasn't sort of sitting there going, oh, can he afford $3,500 worth of surgery? It's like, well, yeah, it can, because I know I'll get the money back, so I'm just wondering.
I think insurance was listed for my book. Have a memory of that as one of the care and maintenance package items? It was, is what I thought. So, yeah, it is, and, you know, it's common sense in a way, when you know that's not that common, but the idea that if you had some other inanimate device that provided you with daily support to allow you to do the very things that you want to do to have a fulfilled existence broke down, they would want to know what sort of insurance you have about that, rather than having to replace it or, you know, fork over the maintenance costs. So it's a bit like driving around without third-party insurance or a comprehensive insurance for your vehicle. It's like, it makes sense to have that as an offer and to be included in the running costs of that particular asset. So
would the insurance come out of the NDIS package?
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't think of it in terms of coming out of the package. Think of it as being part of your
part of the package, or would it come out of our pensions?
No, there are people who will have dogs who might be in receipt of pension, potentially, but no, not out of pension. It's a cost of the package.
Oh, good.
So you ask, this is the things I need in order to run my dog, as it were, one of the better sort of analogy, and insurance is one of the things that should be included in that. Otherwise, there's a cost that the system then would have to say, well, we won't pay for your insurance, but then they're going to have to fork over the vet cost for when you do need to get something like an insurable item that could have been insured against isn't insured, then who's going to pay for that? So the agency then would have to come up with a strategy around how they manage damaged or injured or sick or ill dogs on the way through. And I don't think that you'd be willing to do that, or someone might have a better idea, but I think the safest thing to do is insure the asset.
Excuse me, David. We already have the government deciding, starting from Victoria, we already have the government deciding what drugs we can get on the PBS. So, is that better?
Yep.
Okay. We already have the government deciding what drugs we can get and what we can't get on the PBS. Who will make the decision as to whether we can have a guide dog or whether a white cane just does the same job?
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the questions I asked very early in the piece when the draft report came out, because when they started using the term reasonable and necessary, and whenever anyone in government starts using that terminology, you worry, because it provides enough wriggle room to arbitrarily decide the nature of reasonableness. And I don't think there's a really obvious, clear, unambiguous answer. I think it comes down to the service providers and us as individuals knowing the difference between what cane use and dog use can offer and provide, and reflecting that back in the needs and goal determination. So you need to be able to say, well, what are the things that handling a dog give me that a cane simply cannot do. And like even getting here today, I'd still be trying to get here with my white cane. Now, I'd get there eventually, I wouldn't give up, but it would just be, it wouldn't be equitable and it wouldn't be dignified. But you know, some people are quite happy to maintain, or some people, as I've learnt, do canes and dogs at the same time. Oh, well, whatever your need set is, that's fine. But I don't think you want to set it up as an either or. I think it's about recognising that canes can offer something, dogs can offer something else, and it's up to, if an agency hitherto was prepared to say, I think you've been assessed as being a suitable candidate for dog placement, that they need to be able to be a bit more explicit about what are the determinations around an O&M program that suddenly, or not suddenly, but over the course of time, might think, actually, because of the things you do in your life and the things you want to do, there's about being some preemptive and some early work from the service providers to say, how are we going to, not fashion an assessment process, but to articulate the needs of the individuals that reflect that the answer here is the provision of a dog. Not just, I need mobility support, do some knucklehead gamble, say, here's a $10 white cane. It's not good enough to simply talk in the old terms. We've got to be much more explicit about the independent guiding capability I need to be able to find my way through complex areas, because I want to work in those areas, I volunteer in those areas, I want to shop in like local and distant places. I need the support and the guiding and navigation outcomes that white cane can only deliver. White cane offer can deliver the barriers to me. It won't avoid them. It'll find them. And there's an important distinction between dogs and canes. But I don't think the system's pretty dumb to this. So it's a really good question. I don't think the answer is yet readily apparent. Paul would probably be really useful at this point to provide, if I can put you in, if you have any other thinking around that important distinction.
I'm getting over to Paul now.
Just reiterate what you're happening on.
The distinction between from a service provider position about the determination about suitability of a cane and/or dog for someone, because the question was who's going to determine whether your mobility needs can be resolved reasonably and necessarily by a cane or by a dog.
So. All dog guide users in the room, which is that all the agency have an assessment process of one sort or another. And I think as you described, David, we'll need to articulate quite clearly what the benefit of the dog to the individual will be. As the room is pretty well full of dog guide users, you as individual would be able to describe to me what those advantages to you are, but I'm familiar with many. Speed and ease of movement being one, less stress with travel being another very significant factor. So in our communication, as your partner, in effect, we'll need to make those things very clear to the agency that these are the benefits to be derived by the provision of a guide dog in order to ensure that the agency is going to fund it.
And in support of your goals and objectives in your life.
And so, from Dallas view, I'm going to hand the microphone over to Harry for the senior.
Paul's right. Initially it's about the choice that you make as an individual about what form of mobility you want. But then it's the organisation, of course, has that assessment process to determine whether you are actually eligible. And then that's the next step, where the government would say, or NDIA might say, well, can't you do without a dog? Can't you cope with a cane? But it's about the choice you've made. You say, no, well, the dog's going to provide this for me in a better way than a cane will. And that's the choice. And so that then. The service provider provides whatever form of mobility you require or are eligible for, because there are some people that even will struggle to use a white cane. They might need to use a four-wheel walker or wheelchair or whatever it might be, or other form of mobility use. So there's choices there that will be recommended by the organisation. And similarly with the dog, you know, there are people that might want a dog, but it's the role of the organisation to assess them and to give them an informed decision about whether they are actually able to achieve their goals with a dog.
And I think this is the, I mean, thanks Harry, I think it's an important bit that I'd be very dismayed and disappointed if the agency were to come back and ask, couldn't you do that better with a different level of aid, purely on an economic basis? I think that's not what the system should be about.
Absolutely.
The process should be, on the basis of the assessment of your requirement, in partnership with subject matter experts who are the service providers in the space, that this has been the determined for suitability for a dog. It's not then up to the agency to turn around and say, oh, actually, based on no experience and no knowledge whatsoever, we're going to come up with another solution to your mobility problem. They don't have that capacity or the understanding or the knowledge, and we can't let the agency take on that role in the absence of any knowledge. Now, this is what I said earlier on. We have a responsibility to ourselves and to the, you know, to the viability and feasibility and the longevity of the system to drive some of this. And it isn't either or in any of these cases. It's not just like you don't want to set up this dichotomy that says cane or dog is they're equivalent in terms of what they can do. There might be overlap in some of what they do, but that's immaterial when you're trying to map onto your goals and expectations around the rest of your life, what you need to be able to achieve that. Now, in the face of that level of detail and clarity when you go to a planning process, I can't see an agency prepared or able or willing to say, that's not going to, your needs can be met in this way. They don't have the capacity. And if it comes to that in terms of the way the scheme operates in the scheme, yeah, because they will do that. If they do that around that, they will do it around, we don't really need a motor in that wheelchair because you don't go very far, so, you can rely on your natural supports, The whole system will revert back to the way it was for decades. So, it's a bit like, it's a bit like if little banks go bust, then don't worry because everyone will be screwed. So,
David, we've got Penny, Greg, Stephanie, then Michelle.
Yeah, this is Penny from Victoria again. I'm just wondering, is there any scope to obtain services from outside Australia if they're unavailable here? I was just thinking, if there are, if your aspirational goal is to be able to, move around independently, and you think that that's going to be best met by having a dual-trained guide dog because you're also in a wheelchair, but that service isn't available in Australia. I mean, I know we're talking about getting canes in from America and all over the world. What about other services?
I think, I don't build the system don't pay me enough, or don't pay me anything, actually, so that's why I can say what I say about it. I think there's probably a couple of things that could happen there. A, you could have a broker here in terms of the service provider might deliver that through them. So an accredited service provider here might simply have that on their list of new services, and that could be a way of bringing the service in from an overseas place through an existing provider. I doubt whether internationally you could be a registered provider. Could you meet all the requirements of the scheme? If they did, there may be, if there isn't a real impediment to it, I think the issue might be one of the scheme might say taxpayers' dollars are going to be spent as best we can within Australia. And so there may be limits about the agreements between how things are funded that might preclude paying people overseas. It may not even be possible at this stage. But the workaround would be to get someone here to offer that service and just be a broker for it all. So it's not, I don't think it's beyond the realms of possibility at all. It's just a mechanism. If you can establish that's your need set, then maybe we put it on the agency to come up with a fix. If this service can't be delivered by anyone here, and no one's prepared to start up a company that does it, you can't afford to wait for 10 years for that to happen, how do we do it? How might we get that in? And you might, set up a new category 457 visa. They're doing it all the time, so yeah. I don't think it's impossible. So.
There's lots of epileptics and diabetics out there.
And it's probably going to be more.
David, Greg Madsen from Perth. Just want to throw this into the mix. You know, we're talking about the provision of guide dogs, but one of the things that, you know, you alluded to this in a couple of times, and that is the access of dogs. And to get good access to dogs, you need good advocacy. And I'm aware that the Australian government, as far as its funding goes towards advocacy, is moving away from what they call diagnostic-specific advocacy funding. So that is for people who are blind, for people who are deaf, and they want cross-disability funding to be the way that they go, so they've got, you know, so they makes it easier for government. They've got one point of call, supposedly, where they get their advice from. Obviously, there's going to be some danger in and around that. So it's going to be very difficult. You know, right at the time when we're in an NDIS and dogs are being provided, and we need strong, good advocates to make sure that our needs are met. At that same time, advocacy funding is being pulled away from those people, so it's going to be left to people like DGHA, who don't get any funding at all from government, and people in this room as to advocate on their own behalf to make sure that they get their needs met. And obviously some of the schools will also be involved in some of that advocacy as well, but they will be, we won't have their hands tied, but they'll be providing dogs, and we'll probably want to have distance from advocacy as well. So you know, that's it's going to be. I just want to throw that into the mix and about, you know, people's opinions in and around you know, the need for advocacy.
Well, I think I heard as I came in, someone had mentioned the role of BCA, and you know, for a national consumer entity, it gets nowhere near the level of funding support that it should have. And I mean, I think, like the Dog Guide Handlers Association, $20 amount once off is not a lot of money to pay, but it also means there's no money in the system.
Yeah.
You know? So, and I know there's a capacity pay thing we get in, but $20 for BCA and for lifetime, it, on the one hand, I don't want to have it that individuals and the end users pay for everything, because that's what's going to happen ultimately anyway. But I'd like to see get more money for those for the advocates who are set up specifically for consumer advocacy. Basically, that's what it's what exists. It's not about a forum for service providers or an industry group. It's actually about the consumers. And so if there's going to be a peak body who can best represent the needs of users of those services, that's one of them that needs to be there. And the other avenues are to try and figure out how to get access to the political process to make sure that those needs are met.
How did it survive in the 50s and 60s when there was, or 70s, when there was all that solidarity there, though? Did it have any more funding than it does now?
Who's that?
BCA.
It predates me, and I'm only a member. Is anyone who had a long time in BCA know?
It was basically grassroots advocacy, and that's probably what it would probably head towards again. Or find funding from other sources is what it's going to need to do if government's going to have this cross disability.
And I think
what do you mean by grassroots advocacy, Greg?
People like you. You go into a restaurant and the restaurant owner says you can't come in here, and you say, "Well, yes, I can." You know, that's grassroots.
Right. Advocacy. Sure, I mean, this is the thing. There is no one advocacy vector or solution that will get everyone everything. It does depend on the battles you fight and where you pick them, and that's up to each of us individually to try and figure that out. But we need to be able to aggregate up our knowledge base and our intent into meaningful axes of action, for example. Individually, we can all take that on as little or as much as we think we need to. And I encourage people to do it. It's sometimes, some of the other times, the only way you can ever get effective change in your local environment is to do that yourself. And certainly, as you alluded to, that the government interest in systemic sort of advocacy is not there. But I think, so when we go back to like an NDIS type situation, we're advocating all the way through, and it's yet still not clear to me, now that we can actually have subject matter experts work with us in terms of pre-planning and in an assessment process, at some point the agency expects to see the person at the other side of the desk, and maybe with a personal advocate, but not with a service provider. Because at some point, the system has to be sure that what the service provider is saying in an advocate context is good for the client, is good for the participant in the scheme, and not simply good for the service provider.
Yep.
So there's a conflict around that sort of stuff. But I think the pressure is, and as I've alluded to earlier on, we need to be saying to the system, unless and until you have the expertise and knowledge to deliver up to me a meaningful and useful plan, I need to have people with me who understand what my needs are. And if that is a service provider, then you figure out how to manage the conflict of interest. But I want a plan that actually works for me, and the way I get that is by having someone work with me as far along that system as I need them to end up with a plan that meets my objectives and goals. So if they're pushing back against that, the remedy has to be that the raison d'etre for this scheme is to actually meet the needs of the participants, not to provide some sort of arbitrary anti-competitive barrier that suggests that, you know, we can't provide, you know, professional service as service providers and somehow push the boundaries of being anti-competitive. I think that's not a good enough reason to exclude the subject matter experts from my planning process, because I don't want a plan that doesn't work. I want one that actually does work. And in the absence of me knowing everything I need to know, because I'm just a user, I'm just a consumer of this space, I want to get access to the experts. And they, often as not, until someone puts their hand up and says, okay, I'll be a third-party expert in something, we're going to rely on the service providers, which isn't unreasonable. I mean, they have understood us as clients for a long time, but it's up to you, and it's up to you how much you want them with there. They don't have to be part of the process, but I think one of the things we've learned in the early days of people going through the planning process is there's no... The system, the agency bends over backwards not to be helpful in that sense, not even that they're trying to make things harder. They're just, their job isn't to actually tell you what you need or how to get it or what to do. Their job is to just roll this process out. Your job is actually to be equipped with all the knowledge you need, but they don't necessarily tell you how to get that. So on the one hand, they tell you, they don't give you a clear indication of, you know, who the service providers are, all the services they may offer, all the things you might need to know before you even sign up for an assessment. And so you can understand how sometimes poor assessment processes result from that, because people can phone up there who don't know anything about low vision services. But how do they know what their needs are? If you don't know what O&M is, how do you know to ask for it?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then you've got to fill out the paperwork, literal paperwork. So, sorry, I don't do forms.
I'm at the point of that with my moving over to self-managed funding support, and I have mental health and anxiety issues, and I'm sitting there looking at all those forms going,
Right, I mean, my immediate reaction, of course, to paperwork is that, hey, I don't do that. Not because I probably, well, I probably wouldn't want to do it even if I could say, but yeah, now I've got a good excuse. But also, it's a government agency, and they're required at law, and their own taking other groups of the guidelines and DDA to make this stuff accessible. It's not appropriate to give someone who is vision impaired stuff that needs them to be able to see. Now, I'm not quite sure why that is not understood, but there needs to be some self-advocacy going to say, well, you either need to provide that in a format, an accessible format that I can use this with, or provide me with some direct assistance model, and someone's going to have to sit down and fill this out for me. Because it's not something I do, or you can expect my natural supports to do for me. That's not equitable or dignified, right? DDA, equitable and dignified. So you have an obligation as an entity, a government-funded entity, to do this better than what you're doing. So, and that's where, again, PCA might be a point of call. Even some of the schools, perhaps, or agencies should be able to help in that regard. And so... and do a bit of advocacy in that. So it's not good enough if it's not accessible, isn't it? It's frustratingly impossible to accept these days.
Stephanie had a comment.
Yeah, I just had a slight concern that there's just going to be too many organisations involved. You know, we've got the dog bite schools involved, and we're all going to have the other agencies involved, you know, for our funding and what have you. And I think, you know, if it's not careful, there's going to be a lot of misunderstandings and a lot of issues, simply because there's so many people involved that, it's going to be become difficult to, keep the track of everything. And the other concern I have is that, the opportunity to come on and say, well, no, you're not suitable for a job, and if they don't want to provide funding, they'll put whatever reasons they can to deny the funding.
Well, I think, I mean, they're legitimate concerns, I think, but I think it does rely, as a sector, as I said very early on, you know, to be prepared to unite and forego some of the divides of the past and actually recognise that there's value in combining and understanding the dog guide space for and on behalf of the agency. They need to know that this is how this bit of the sector works. This is how we establish the need, and we can determine that this is what impact it has on people's lives in terms of meeting their goals and expectations. And it's not that negotiable. Right? It's not up to anyone else to decide. It's up to the subject matter experts and the users of this system to drive those outcomes. And if we sit back and let an outcome, a substandard outcome, rest, then it will just provide that opportunity, just sets that precedent that will provide an opportunity to do it less well in the future. Because money will always be an option, but I think part of our, I was speaking to someone there, but as you know, they were talking about not engaging the NDIS as a system, even though they were an existing dog user. And as I said before, bad idea, well, depending on your own financial setup, but there's $2,500 going begging for an existing dog user per year that you should, if you're an eligible in a launch area or whatever, say in Barwon. But also, part of the issue was they said, well, if my dog's only 5 years old, all things being equal, I won't need another dog for possibly 3, 5, 7 years or something, depends on the working life. But I think the important thing there is to flag to the agency that in 2 years' time or 3 years' time, you will expect to have that dog replaced. Because by foreshadowing what the load is and the system of number of dogs that are out there, that's how they can actually meet the demand. It's when things happen that they expected, or they didn't foresee, or they couldn't phase the amount of money that they had. That's when you run into problems with people looking for ways to cut down expense. So if we have an opportunity to inform the system that we've got X number of dogs, 200 dogs or 400 dogs in the system, and the timeline for those replacements for those individuals is whatever it would be, 5, 6 years, and here's the agency service providers can give you the averages of those. That will help the system phase its funding around those aids and not present as a big issue. One of the things that we had discussed, and I don't know whether it's resolved or not, my view around the funding should be might be amortised over the life of the dog, for example. So if the dog costs $20,000, for example, pull a figure from somewhere, that over the 5 years of working life that you may notionally give it, that's $4,000 a year that would be paid each year. So again, it's just a financial mechanism, but what it does is it allows them to understand their demand as it heads out to the, as time heads out to the right, but also allows us to program in, well, okay, with this dog notion, it's going to last 7 years. Year six, we're going to start looking at training up and supplying another one at the end of that 7th year. And that helps them actually meet that demand. So we do have a lot of, you know, people saying we've got more and more demands and responsibilities on us. Don't want to make it too onerous, but I think we do have a role to play here in helping the agency and in a sense sort of precluding it from being able to make those sorts of calls by saying, oh no, dogs are too expensive, or wheelchairs are too expensive, or I don't know, 24-hour attendant care is too expensive. These are all the tenets on which the scheme is predicated. You know, they can't be allowed to turn around and say, oh actually, 24-hour care is too much, we'll make it 12. Mm. I don't think they'll be allowed to do that without the scheme failing. But that doesn't mean I think it won't necessarily fail. Depends if we ever lose lose the Senate to the same party that controls the lower house again, I think we'll see a lot of damage, more so than we've got now. So just remember that next election. Just imagine how badly off we would be if the current federal government actually did control the Senate more than they do now.
Yeah.
It's a scary thought. No matter which side of politics you want to support, it's never good, either side. It's never good for them to control it. So.
Joyce has a question.
Yeah, I'd like to question the extent to which we can change things government-wise or not because of the bureaucracy. I'd like to draw your attention to a bit of history. The Disability Services Act of 1986 went through Parliament. The Disability Services Act of 1986 went through Parliament with bipartisan acclamation, and it was going to solve all our problems because it was going to break down the rigid funding models of previous legislation. For example, Gough Whitlam's Handicapped Persons Assistance Act of 1974 was ready for the first time. It provided more services for more people with disability, but it retained strong central control, and it only rewarded the most able of the disabled through the rehabilitation within the Department of Social Security. People were only entitled to service from that program if they were employable and could pay back the service in tax. The Handicapped Persons Assistance Act retained sovereign employment and institutional accommodation. And Gough Whitlam's Royal Commission on Human Relationships freed the voices of many people who were not happy with that arrangement. The Senator Don Grimes Handicaps Programs Review of 1982-1983 did likewise. That followed the initiative of the International Year in 1981. And the Disability Services Act of 1986 was founded upon the results of that inquiry published in New Directions. And the point of the Disability Services Act was to put more power in the hands of the consumers, to break down the rigid top-down funding models from Canberra such that people could form non-government organisations out in the community and apply for funding, and providing that the strict guidelines were met. That funding would be available. Even the located disability movement could apply for funding under those circumstances, and I think many organisations have done under the legislation. But I served as a token appointment on the Board of Management in Toowoomba for many years, and I could influence no decision whatsoever. Brochures would come onto the table, $10,000 for a weekend school away to pick up on the latest terminology or leadership skills or administration skills. That's where the money went, on the workshops, and it didn't go to the people with a disability. And I just found from that experience that service providers are not going to let go of their authority. They will take it upon themselves to interpret our needs, and once they do that, they cannot be trusted not to put their own needs first. And I watched a lot of people without much by way of qualification, for example, policy writers become very wealthy during since 1986 came in, because with all the talk about consumerism and self-determination, you know, the agencies that receive the greatest reward in terms of funding were the agencies which could produce the most comprehensive suite of accountability documents. And that only made things worse for us, because these documents only served to legitimise our protest and leave us nowhere to go. Time and time again, I'd be referred to a strategic planning statement or a managerial report or some other document. So there you are, there's all the power you want on paper, but if you do not try to exercise, we would just smack down in the usual manner. And I just question the extent to which the NDIS is going to change that situation, because it seems to me that there are certain officers who monitor and administer the Act that have what would still seem to be discretionary power to overrule everyone and impose their own viewpoints. Well, I'd like to ask David for your opinion on that. Like, how much can things change? How much can things change given that once people achieve a position in the bureaucracy beyond that to which their national talents would entitle them, they can't be shifted?
Unfortunately, I think you could look at just about any part of government and what you said is applicable. Indictment of the way we do business in Western democracies in general. But that said, you mentioned there are people you think that are in positions who can still exercise their will over. Now, are you talking about ministers, or are you talking about senior bureaucrats?
Senior bureaucrats.
And what position would that be in relation to the NDIS legislation?
I read somewhere in a document that people had... A group of professionals had just been appointed at about $110,000, $120,000 to oversee certain aspects of the administrative procedures of the NDIS. I was just thinking that people on that kind of money if they're paying that kind of money to criticise or reform the system, then they're not going to exert themselves. If they're being paid by the system to criticise the system and reform the system, they're not going to exert themselves. And I sometimes wonder how much the stagnation that we see in the disability sector is a result of people not wanting to rock the boat because they're doing too well out of their salaries. And I just don't think that the NDIS is going to be exempt from that, because there will have to be those top-grade public servants, bureaucrats administering it. And I don't think they're just going to allow too much input from us because they consider that too volatile.
Yeah, I think what you're really saying is, I think that, as I said before, is it similar across any program of this type where that can happen? Doesn't mean that it will, but there is always going to be a public service element to the delivery and implementation of a scheme, particularly one this large. So the question's legitimate. I mean, your cynicism is valid, but I think the challenge is to figure out, as it is with any advocacy challenge, to figure out where are the points where we can make that difference. And I think one of the major differences that differ from the history that you provided from the 70s on is that the mechanism that they're rusted onto for delivering money into the system is 180 degrees from what the past has offered. And the major difference that brings is that the money, and this was part of my original criticism of the system, and continues to be one, is that they cast the blanket over the entire disability community without benchmarking or understanding how it actually works. Right? Now, that meant that there's going to be a lot of casualties in this process. They acknowledge that. There are going to be organisations and service providers who simply do not survive, because the way they've changed the game is that the money now does not come to the institutions that you, I think, referred to as being some of the beneficiaries of the system that is top-down. And so the notion of block funding, as it was in days gone past, is not something that the scheme will support wholesale. There's still be some going on, but it's not going to be the way it was done anymore. So that, by its very nature, and I think creates a whole lot of risk around, well, how do we make sure that people get the service they need? We'll discuss those in this hearing here today. But it does also make it incumbent on those organisations who want to survive into, well, into the 21st century, that they have to figure out how to compete in that space, they have to figure out how to survive in that space, because they can no longer survive on looking up to the state government or even the federal governments to provide them with their sustenance, to do and continue to do business as they always have done. So the days of business as usual are very, very much over. The question will be, how do institutions and organisations respond to this brave new world where they've been not so much neutered as much as really disempowered by being able to direct traffic around all of those things. Like, say for example, you've got, for example, in Victoria, you've got at least two dog providers, and someone else might choose to set up from another state in there as well. So, in that sense,
you've got two in South Australia too.
And then someone might decide to go over the border. So you end up with the prospect of none of those organisations are going to be funded by the government just to be, at least in terms of the NDIS. And most of them are perhaps now somewhat over. But they're not going to get money from the government to just do stuff in the hope that it meets a client need. They're going to get money from the government when they meet a client need. And that client's going to have to go to them and demand that service or request that service through them. And the process of this is called the NDIS, for example. And that's how they're going to get funding, and that's how they're going to be sustainable in that model, not from the old model, which was they just had money and hopefully they're...
How are they going to survive while they're waiting for the money?
This is a really good question.
Charity.
This is one of the questions about, particularly when it related to... And I always had in my head...
Okay. I want to ask one question. The dogs we have now, when the NDIS comes in our particular states, will they be included, or do we have to wait until we get a new dog before all the package is rolled out?
What do you mean included?
Like, for example, cost. Like Orchids too.
Yeah.
I got her last year. Vet bills are only limitedly covered by Cedar, and I've got her on Green Cross Vets. Leave it. But that doesn't cover operations, so I'd have to take out other insurance for that. And I am one of these people who is, I'm on a pension, and I work as a musician, so I get limited work.
Alright, well.
We have someone who can answer that question. Yeah.
I spoke to her before, but
yeah.
Who's going to answer me?
Who's it?
It's Katie.
Oh,
okay. I live in Newcastle, which is one of the launch sites. I myself haven't gone down the track of NDIS yet, but I have friends who have their guide dogs funded. So they've obviously joined the scheme already having a dog. And so they have things reimbursed. And I've also had a friend who has just had her, like, brand new dog, and that's been entirely funded.
Cool.
It's the first thing ever.
So we're right at that cusp now. So to answer that direct question is, when you engage the system, and you have an existing dog, that existing dog isn't funded in any way because you've got an existing dog, but the service, the care and maintenance package is because you've got a dog. So you would engage the system, so I have a guide dog, I have a dog guide, these are my care and support needs, and that's the agreed package I spoke of before, that Katie is in, and that would include your vets and your insurance and the food and all the other things. So from day one, and I'll just make a brief point about participation in the scheme is one of those things where it comes back to us, our responsibility. And in many of the launch sites, and I can only speak about Victoria with any vague sense of knowledge, is that there's funding provided to a service provider to deliver services in an NDIS launch site. It comes at the expense of that agency's funds. So, for example, in Victoria, because they made an estimate about the number of blind and low vision people who will access the NDIS in the Barwon launch site, they've taken money off Guide Dogs Victoria to do that. So that means then if people arbitrarily who are eligible but don't engage the scheme in the launch site have actually taken money out of GDV's pocket. You raise an interesting question there about would they still expect to get services from GDV outside the scheme? So it's a double dip in a sense, because the government's already taken the money out of the pocket, and then someone's going to come to the front door and say, oh, by the way, I still want to get my O&M, I still want to get my training, I still want to get those other services. So it's not quite a moral or ethical dilemma. It might be just something people think, well, it's their choice. But I think it raises some interesting ethical and moral dilemmas for a service provider who is struggling with the limited resources around to have money taken out of their bank in order to deliver service under the NDIS, only to have someone expect to get that same service while not actually engaging that scheme. So that's something to ponder on, I think, if we're in that situation. There may well be cost to us as a well, to the sector broadly, but as service providers within it, that are unintended. So that decision not to engage is one of the key points people are critical of the loss of the mobility allowance if you engage the NDIS system. And as I've said all the way through, it's really important to say you don't lose that money if you build into your package the fact that you need transport access. And it means you could get more than the mobility allowance if you can adequately articulate your transport needs. And it's not good enough to have a partner with a car and then they give you nothing. That's not equitable, not dignified. I don't want to drive with my wife anymore than I have to. Fortunately, she's in Victoria. But she drives, she does all the driving. So, you know, I'll start at her at every level because that's a pain. But, you know, it shouldn't be up to anyone to decide that, you know, because I've got access to someone else with a vehicle that somehow I don't have access to that on my phone. That's not on. So,
David, we've got choice and then Greg.
That's all going, yeah. So just remember, put transport in your plan and your mobility, lack of mobility allowance doesn't matter.
Joyce here, I'd like to make a comment. When we take a look at the disability sector in general, you can see that charity is still very much a major method of raising money, and they still raise their money by exploiting and reinforcing the very social prejudices which they know to be the chief cause of our problems. The Guide Dog Training Centre in Queensland, not so long ago, had the worst advertisement that I've ever come across, with a kid in a cage but begging to be set free by a guide dog.
Mm. Oh my goodness.
Yeah, it was just rancid. And a lot of us complained about it, and we were told by the administration we have to raise the money that way because we don't get government funding. And it seems to me that there are some organisations which will thumb their noses at government funding because they don't want the administrative restrictions, and they will argue that we live in a free enterprise society and there's nothing stopping them from going cap in hand at the public the way that charitable organisations always have done. And I think that any attempt on the part of the government, on the part of people with disabilities, to ameliorate our social status by moving on to government-directed services is still going to be counterbalanced by these pathetic images that keep coming out across the media by people who insist on using the old method of fundraising. And I'd like to ask David for your opinion on that one. How can a service reflect the status of the person in the community or the ability of the status in the community when it's in constant competition with this downward theology which sees everything in terms of forced dichotomies and which will always try to segregate us so that they can make money out of us?
It's a slightly problematic area, I'll put it that way best. Look, and I think there's a lot of ways, we probably don't have the time right now to answer all of it or address it, but it's really interesting, and I didn't know of that particular type of response. But it is the dilemma of the charitable sector, that on the one hand it's about empowerment, want of a better term, and yet on the one hand, you know, it's fluffy labradors that bring in the dollars. And that's just true. So I don't think you're going to sit back and say, well, we won't use our dogs as a means of getting... it's the how you do it. And I think if people have a problem with the way their organisation or their service provider or their state body or whatever it is does business, then you do something about it. You either join up as a member of that organisation or get on the board of committee and you make your thoughts known. If you've got these people in marketing communications who don't know anything about what they're talking, then it's up to us to actually articulate that and say, this isn't the way we want to do business. If someone wants to go out as a charity and forego government funding for whatever reason they might do it, even though there's not much in there, they are going to have to live by that. Now, you're going to see in terms of the social media approach to today, if you get that wrong, you're wrong for a long time. Right? Now, if you're going to put the requirement for people who already give more money than they ever have had to, without option. If you pay tax, you pay money to the NDIS, whether you like it or not. Now, that's going to have an impact on discretionary giving. And no one's done any modelling on that, despite our asking, and the money they were paying KPMG and all these PricewaterhouseCoopers for the development of the scheme. We wanted to know what estimate there was for people not wanting to give, because they're already giving in the Medicare levy increase. Right? Now, they didn't do it. It happened with the Queensland flood. For those in Queensland, had the horrible floods. People gave willingly as soon as it happened, and then they struck a levy. And people are really annoyed that they got hit twice. Now, that's going to happen with the disability community. So if you're going to risk it and do stupid things with trying to advertise and market the community in that way, there will be backlash in a lot of different ways. And I see it as my obligation. I would rise up against that personally and say, that's not on. I don't live my life like that. You don't represent me, and you don't represent the disabled community in that way either. That might be the only way you can actually effectively do that. If they want to make stupid decisions at board level, then they can do that, but they need to be informed of the impact that has on the people who they're supporting to serve. And I think that's a really key... no one here, I think, is a shrinking violet, which is great, and I love it, but...
What's a shrinking violet?
Even Agent Orange won't keep the shrinking violets. So I'll say more power to us as a group, but remember, we are coming from a lot of different places, but we need to unite a bit more. So happy to talk over beer and wine at some point. But thanks very much.
What about iced chocolate?
Yes, iced chocolate as well.
This has been a Dog Guide Handlers Australia audio presentation. If you would like further information on Dog Guide Handlers Australia or like to listen to further audio, please go to our website www.dgha.org.au. Thank you. Do you always have to have the last word?